Good morning and welcome. Before we start, I have a request to make. At the end of this forum, we have another large event going to take place in this room, we hope starting at 12:15. So moving everyone in and out is going to be a challenge. You probably saw a buffet table set up in the outer room. That's for the group that's coming in, so don't anybody touch any of that stuff. But what I would like to suggest, because there are always folks who want to speak with the speaker and he wants to speak with people and get their comments, at the end, let me let Howard and Secretary Eagleburger, who is carrying Howard's bags today for him.
As usual, always carrying.
Let me ask you to let them leave the room, and they will go downstairs, the inside stairway, and Mr. Hart will be will station himself at the bottom of the steps to talk with anyone who cares to talk with him. It's a great pleasure to welcome Howard Hart back. He was here several months ago, and the copy of his talk then has become the most requested video that we've had in some time. Actually, requests came in from all over the country, and because he was cited as a source in the article that Seymour Hersh published in The New Yorker about 3 weeks ago for what's going on in Iran and other matters, I thought it would be time to get Mr. Hart back and try to pick his brain some more. As most all of you know, he was raised in the Far East. His father was an investment banker, and he got caught up in the Second World War and was actually interned in a Japanese prison camp for an extended period of time and was liberated by American soldiers. It was the feeling that he had when an American soldier lifted him out and carried him to safety when he was a young boy that really lit the fire of his patriotism and his desire to serve the country and hopefully save others as he himself was saved. He was educated back here. He went to Cornell and the University of Arizona. He has degrees in Oriental Studies and political science. He speaks Hindustani, Indonesian, German, and sort of a fractured, broken English. His service in the CIA is legendary. His exploits have been celebrated in two terrific books, Charlie Wilson's War and in Ghost Wars by Steve Cole. Many of you know Steve Cole spoke here in September, and this book has been nominated for the award as the best book on foreign policy in the last year. And there's more than a chapter in there about Howard Hart's exploits. He served in Iran, in Pakistan, and Germany, among other places. And at the end of his service, he received the CIA's highest award, the Distinguished Intelligence Medal. There is nobody better prepared to speak to us, as Howard Hart will, about the global war against radical Islamic terrorism.
Thanks, George. Thank you all very much for turning up on this nice cold day to come listen to me again. I'm very much pleased to be here. I don't know why. I think this is such a tremendous forum to talk to people, and we certainly come or watch on their, you know, network site a lot. I'm going to be very ambitious today. I'd like to take you through kind of a whirlwind tour, which won't take more. I mean, it covers about 13 or 14 centuries, but really focuses on the bottom line, which is our involvement in Iraq at this point. I would like to tell you that I have tried my best in thinking this through and preparing for this lecture to do it as a professional intelligence officer as opposed to representing some political view or whatever, and in effect trying to step back a bit from being an American. I mean, I'd want to look at this as a professional intel officer who says, well, there's a big problem out there. What is all this about? Why is it? And I hope I will not betray your trust in me to do that. Of course, I'm going to get to some opinions, and I'll try to label those, so they'll be perfectly evident to you, but I'm really trying to look at facts the hard way. I have two or three dim qualifications to do this. One, I guess I've been fussing with the intelligence world and the Middle East for over 40 years, including my academic training. Much more important in some ways as regard Iraq, I spent well over 3 years running the CIA's covert war against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, where we defeated the Soviet Union. And as then Foreign Minister of the Soviet Union, Shevardnadze, said, that was the last nail in the Soviet coffin. So for me, I can look at this terrific and unpleasant insurgency in Iran in many ways from the insurgents' point of view. I know what we did and tried to do in Afghanistan to a Soviet occupier, an invader, and I can sense what the guys, the people inside Iran, are trying to do back to us. And since the world little is new in it, I think I have a good feel for what they're up to and what they're trying to do. And I'm trying to bring that experience to bear to share with you all. I think there are a couple of things that are terribly, terribly important. The first one I would like to address is, why is it that, I must tell you a story first. The story is a famous Middle Eastern tale that is supposed to enlighten all young Foreign Service and clandestine service officers, and everybody else will spend time to listen, about the truce of the Middle East. And the story is such. A scorpion is sitting on the left bank of the River Jordan and wants to cross, but a scorpion cannot swim, so he cannot cross. A turtle wanders up. Scorpion says to turtle, see, you're going to cross the river. Do you mind if I get on your back? You take me over. Turtle says, not a chance. You'll sting me, and I will die and drown in the river. Scorpion says, nah, no way. I wouldn't do that. I drown too, right? So he finally persuades the turtle. They get in the middle of the Jordan. Of course, the scorpion stings the turtle. Turtle, with his last gasping breath, turns his head up and says, why did you do that? You know you're going to die. And the answer is, this is the Middle East. Make of that what you will, but there's a great deal of truth in that. That's the Middle East. I also want to quickly say, anyone who says they're a great Middle Eastern scholar or knowledgeable expert, be very careful. The last thing in the world I would ever do is say, I'm a big expert on the Middle East. Nonsense. I mean, it's too complicated. Nobody knows how to figure the place out. The first thing I want to talk about is, why is there this tremendous antipathy towards America? You know, the incredible scene of after 9/11, people are dancing around in streets wearing their Harvard University sweatshirts, I will have you know, and their Adidas shoes, but burning American flags. Jubilation. Why is it there's so much animosity? Well, it's a question you can only answer truly if you go back literally to the Crusades, which for us, you know, occurring in 1100, 1200, are so remote that it seems bizarre that that would still have an impact. And yet, if you listen or read the texts of sermons done by mullahs and mosques all the way across the Muslim world, not just the Middle East, you will constantly hear references to the Americans as crusaders, capital C, back again. That memory is as important and vital and present as you could possibly imagine. And why are Americans supposed to be a bunch of French knights who are out, you know, to conquer and kill and rape and loot and burn, and who did all of that to Byzantium, the Christian city and empire? I don't know, but it's part of it. We're West. And since none of the rest of the West really matters much anymore in their view, and that's very important, Nobody really matters much but the Americans. You have that leftover thing of the Crusades, and I didn't believe that for a long time until, boy, it was indelibly written in my mind after 9/11 when I heard a lot of people talk about it. There's also a question of envy. We see envy everywhere against us as Americans, or let me put it neutrally, the Americans see a lot of envy directed against them, and it isn't nice from places around the world, from a number of European countries and on and on and on. That's human nature. We're all a little annoyed at the zillionaire who does this, that, or the other thing, or blah, blah, blah. Human nature tends towards envy, and there's a lot of that on the American side. I mean, as they look at Americans. Israel and Palestine are an overarching problem that has been reduced to the utter simplistic fact of Israel exists, it should not, you Americans support it, you are bad. That's it. We don't need to discuss this anymore. There is under, again, this question of why they're mad at Americans, a huge failure on the part of the Arab peoples and countries. I want to, for the purposes of honesty, I want to make sure we all understand. What is an Arab? I don't know. We in the West have come to say Arabs are those people who are Muslim, speak Arabic, and live in the Middle East. That's about as good a definition of it as there is. A real true Arab would be a desert Bedouin milling around the middle of Saudi Arabia. I have dealt with Arab intelligence officers in Jordan who were as blonde and blue-eyed as I am, and they were Circassians. They were Albanians, actually, but by ancestry. But they were Arabs. So the Arab world is profoundly unaware of how you run a government, how you run a society, except in the most traditional sort of ways. And that ignorance translates to anger at people who seem to be able to do it. Now, you remember, Egypt did not have an Egyptian in charge of it from the time Ptolemy, one of Alexander of Macedon's generals, turned up in 300 BC, whose great-great-umpty-ump granddaughter was, of course, the gal who seduced Anthony, until Abdelghamer Nasser in middle of the 1950s. That's only a cool 2,000 years. No concept. What does a Saudi Bedouin understand about government? Oh, I mean, that's sort of an oxymoron. Government is a tribe. Government extends as far as the 10 guys I know I'm living with out here in the middle of the desert. There has been no experience. And worse, the experience that has been totalitarian dictatorship, which does not breed a whole lot of things that we as products of the Anglo-Saxon American political experience have come to understand either viscerally or just expect. There is no such history. And so that creates a whole lot of barriers to understand what they're doing, the West, specifically the Americans, again, the only ones who matter, apparently. And it breeds real contempt, and it breeds real anger. Arab psychology. I was told this many, many years ago. I didn't really believe it. I sort of shrugged, said, okay, but now I do. Arabs have a terrific reluctance to accept responsibility, individually, or as a community, or as a country, or whatever. If you, on the one hand, look at Japan and the social concept in Japan of we all do this together, we are all responsible, there is terrific responsibility, the Arabs are sort of on the other end of that spectrum. It's very, very difficult for most Arabs to sit down and accept responsibility, to accept blame, to accept much else but conspiracy theories. They're very big on conspiracy. Everything is a conspiracy. Nothing, no sparrow can fall from the sky. But that Something caused that. Not the fact that poor damn thing died, it just fell out of the sky. There's always a reason that is got to be the real one down underneath all that. And that's not a great way to approach the world. It makes things much harder. Next, they have been horribly failed by their own governments. Horribly failed in almost every sense. Some have been able to pull it off like the little Gulf states where the emirs, the sheikhs, have been smart enough to spread the oil money around well enough so that this tiny little indigenous population is happy, or the Kuwait example. But Egypt, Iraq, governments have failed them terribly. The most glaring example right at the moment being the Palestinian Authority. The extraordinary thing is that the Arab world has desperately looks for heroes and has very few. And yet we see Arafat on his death virtually revered. And the minute the people stopped weeping, they turned around and said, now where's the money he stole? It's the scorpion and the turtle. He will be revered forever, but he looted the place. No secret. Everybody knows it, including a lot of your tax dollars. Everybody knows it, including the Palestinians, who to this day are sort of diligently running around trying to find where it is and never will. There's another huge factor in here that has to do with Islam. I have more respect for Islam than I suspect many Westerners do. And a little bit, I'm going to tell you why. I studied the Quran. I have spent endless hours, some of them the most wonderful in my life, for example, sitting on the desert in the dark of night in Afghanistan, having a discussion through sort of two or three interpreters with a local mullah about God, Islam, and what did he think of the world, while we Soviet airplanes are flying overhead. But Islam, some years ago, I don't quite know when, I'm not sure anybody can put their finger on it, went from being, when they rode out of Saudi Arabia after Muhammad's time and they conquered a huge chunk of the known world. Everything, if you start in the middle of Saudi Arabia and run it all the way across North Africa and cross the straits up into Spain, over the Pyrenees, where they're stopped around 1800 by essentially the French, or we might all be Muslims, or the other hand, where they come around, go up through what is now Palestine, Syria, the Euphrates River area, cross Turkey, cross the Bosphorus, go in, take Hungary, Albania, okay, which we're still seeing the results of these days. And they are stopped right outside Vienna after the New World has been found. I mean, we're not talking millions of years ago. They were stopped at the gates of Vienna, or we might all be Muslim. But then in the middle of that period, in our Middle Ages, in our Western Middle Ages, Islam caused the flowering of the most remarkable civilization in terms of literary work, studies, and medicine. They saved the entire body of Greek thought for us. If it had not been for Islam and its scholars in the 12, the 1000s, the 900s, we'd have lost all of that. And then something funny happens. There's a nosedive. And the nosedive occurs most specifically after the Ottoman Empire, which was just the last expression of many empires or governments running this Middle Eastern Muslim world. When it was rebuffed from Europe, it started going downhill. Now, a funny thing happened. A religion which had been very accepting and very tolerant and very intellectual and very anxious to bring new ideas in, and some of the great names of thinkers in those days, including in the hard sciences, were Arabs, Muslims. There is a rejection on theological grounds of everything foreign, different, and new. And that rejection grows to the point where in, let's say, 1800, just to pick a date, the caliph of the Ottoman Empire, now mind you, Caliph is the number one guy under the Ottoman governments or under the Ottoman structure who is a Sunni Muslim, not a Shia. Only 10% of the world's Muslims are Shias, and most of them live in Iran and Iraq, leaving the other 90% out. He realized that Western Europe was getting awfully good at things like technology, railroad trains, guns, gunboats, all this stuff. And he wanted to send, tentatively and carefully, a few people from what we now call Turkey, from the empire, to Europe to study these things. And as had become the custom, the caliph goes to his number one, if you will, mullah, religious person, and says, is this okay? And he is told, absolutely not. For any good Muslim to leave the empire, to go to Europe, to study the modern developments, is absolutely the wrong thing to do. It is associating with the heathen, the whatever you want to call them, the infidel. If you do it, you contaminate your soul as a good Muslim. You take a railroad train that was just beginning to start to modernize the Ottoman Empire, which at that time is virtually all of the Middle East, and it runs straight into a wall and stops. And frankly, it stopped there for a long time. And what we are seeing today as resurgent or extremist Islam is in many ways that same kind of thinking. And it's bad, and it has held back, particularly peoples of the Middle East, very heavily. Another thing that we need to regard as we try to figure all this out, I remember being told, I think I was even in university, I was told, Islam has no clergy. It has no Vatican. It has no head pope. It is an unstructured religion. Well, that ain't quite true. Now, one of the reasons that we see this vitriol poured on the United States and to a lesser degree the West is because the clergy of Islam, by and large, is composed of hundreds of thousands of local clerics who have all studied at the madrasas, the schools where they go to memorize the Quran forward and backward. Their knowledge, as I've said before, is an inch wide and 3 miles deep, and it's all Quranic. They don't know anything else. And for many years, they have lived lives which are fairly unimportant. Big time on Friday, a lot of influence around the village or the community, but after that, not a whole lot. Now they are the mouthpieces of the new strident, resurgent Islam, where they are. It's not everywhere, just where they are. There's two things about this. This is a very satisfying thing to be. If for a long time you were just a theologian who nobody paid much attention to, all of a sudden, you're a very important arbiter of decisions, political, economic, international, and they like that. And the thing that's interesting is if I promise you that if we sat down and we all went to a mosque today and had a simultaneous translation, say the biggest mosque in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, we would hear the mullahs tell their flock, the Americans are the source of all evil. The Americans have done all of this, et cetera, et cetera, in Riyadh. And that just goes, it's everywhere. And it's kind of scary. I want to tell one short story that goes back to the jealous because you guys are Americans thing. The day after 9/11, I called a Saudi friend of mine who I've known for 25 or 30 years, a man of enormous wealth, most of which he's made, not inherited, who learned how to fly fighter planes here in the States for the Saudi Air Force. You know, three homes in Geneva, stays at Claridge's in London, has a couple homes in America. I called him up, and he said something to the effect that, yeah, hi, Howard, how are you? And I said, okay, but the news back here is awful. He said, yeah, but you guys deserved it. Huh? I slammed the phone down. It took me about 3 days before I called him back and said, you son of a bitch. He said, I'm so sorry. I shouldn't have said that. Well, right. From the heart, right? A lot of the Middle East thinks that way. You deserved it. And add all these things up I've been talking about. Now, I want to make something clear before anybody kills me on my way downstairs what I'm going to do what George tells me to do. Let me tell you why I hugely respect Islam. And this gets very personal. When I was in Tehran after the Shah fell, we were having a bad time. And most of the embassy was gone, and a small group of us, State Department and agency people, hung around to try to do the best we can. And one night, driving down a road after being a good spy, I was stopped by a vigilante committee of Khomeini's followers. Now, these guys, last week, they were all the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, who knows what, but now they were the leading edge of the Revolutionary Guard. And they had all the guns that used to belong to the Shah's army. And that army's gone. There's no police, no army, no nothing. Hauled out of my car, accused of being a CIA spy, which I vehemently denied. Admitted I was an American. And was sentenced to death by a drumhead court-martial. It took about 3 minutes. You're a filthy American CIA spy. This gets your attention. It's not nice. I demanded to see the local mullah, because every block there is a mosque somewhere nearby, so you have a series of blocks, and in the middle of all that there's a mosque. And they trotted a guy out, fairly young man. And fortunately, one of my interlocutors spoke pretty good English. And I said, would you please translate for me to the mullah? And he did. And I said essentially to the mullah, with great enthusiasm, this is wrong. The holy book does not allow this. It forbids this. You are wrong. Tell them. He told them, and I was released. Alhamdulillah, thanks to God. Alhamdulillah. That's the Muslim I have no problem with. And much to the consternation of the locals, who thought that was a lousy idea to let me go. Okay, new subject. Iraq. You have to think about all those things, because truly there's no way to examine this. And I think American policymakers and our Congress are both so woefully in ignorance about this whole thing, that it is mind-blowing. Now, I want to tell you right now, I spent a lot of time agonizing about should we be in Iraq, not should we have gone. That's dead, that's finished. The question is, should we stay in Iraq and keep fighting this fight? And my answer to it is yes, and I'm going to tell you in a few minutes why I think that, and again, I'm going to try to stay with it from the perspective of an intelligence officer looking at a problem. Now, as of 12 hours ago, 1,449 American men and women in the military service have died in Iraq. 1,449. That's a 12-hour-old number. I assume that if we remain in Iraq for some additional years, as we would have to pull this off, those numbers would double and triple and quadruple. And there are kids. 148 only have died in Afghanistan. Now, if we are terrorists in Iraq, I keep confused, there's a Freudian problem there, I know. I've always said I'd like to go back as chief of station with the 82nd Airborne as my group. I have a few scores to settle. If we are terrorists sitting in Iraq today, here's what we're thinking. Now, I'm putting on my Afghanistan hat. The Americans are going to leave. They might even leave damn soon. But they're not going to stay. Translate that from the insurgents saying that to the locals saying that, who says the Americans are going to leave, you know. And when they leave, there are things called reprisals, because if they don't win, we are in extraordinarily deep trouble. Scores will be settled. So it is a certainty the Americans will leave. It's one of the few things that's for sure about Iraq someday. That's a great tool in the hands of the insurgents. It was a great tool in our hands in Afghanistan. There is a fair reason, a fairly strong certainty that any elected government that does materialize in Iraq, assuming one does, will not be an effective national government that seeks to do well by all of the people living in a geographic entity called Iraq. That's a pretty good bet. And it's what the insurgents are betting on, and again, what most Iraqis figure. If we get a government, you're going to trust it, they're going to break up, they're going to be all kinds of things, they're Kurds and this, and besides the guy in the next village who hates me, and blah, 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 blah. There's no experience of government, remember? There's no experience of a commonality of interest. And the insurgents know that, and so does the population sitting on the, you know, barrier or the middle of the road now. They can't, with any great confidence, certainly today, assume that a government that is actually created, and even if it works out nicely and everybody sort of agreed and sits in one big room, that 8 months later they won't have just self-destructed. It is the most sensible, simple thing. If you are an Iraqi, you want to be on the winning side. Almost nothing else matters. You were able to survive under Saddam Hussein because he was the winner and you just do what he told you. And in this particular one now, where there's so much potential to do the wrong thing by somebody, you want to be on the winning side, so you tuck your tail between your legs and you just try to be good boy or girl. Very sensible. If the insurgents say this nascent nation, which has never really been a nation before, remember I'm carefully saying it's a geographic entity populated by all sorts of very different people, most of whom can't stand each other, many of whom can't speak to each other in the same language, is a geopolitical accident. In 1920, Winston Churchill, of some fame, in the wake of World War I, is stuck, well, the Brits are, with this huge bit of territory called the Middle East, Mesopotamia. They've just paid off the Saudis in Saudi Arabia, this tribe of, you know, belonging to a guy named Ibn Saud and all his camels and goats, because he helped them a bit against the Ottoman Empire, which was on the same side as the Germans in the First World War, and they've given Saudi Arabia, given Arabia, Peninsular Arabia, to the Al Saud tribe. Saudi Arabia. That leaves them stuck with a tribe which had been over the guardians of Mecca on the Red Sea. And the guardians of Mecca, the Hashemite family, were a little annoyed. They said, hey, we've run Mecca for many years, and you're coming out of the middle of the desert, and we're the big boys around here. So Winston and friends, they take the two brothers from the Hashemite family who matter, one of whom is the Sharif, the sheriff of Mecca. Can't get to be a bigger dog than that, and send him, ta-da, to Jordan, which they've just created on a piece of paper. That's Jordan. And they send the other brother to, that's Iraq. Draw a line. I love it. I mean, it's nothing like British imperialism. You've got to admire their brass. Right. We'll call that American America. They're so good. Anyway, it's all back to haunt us again, and it's our fault, naturally. There is no national entity in Iraq. And we have to be careful of that. And as today we look, for example, you look at the Kurds, and they seem to be behaving themselves up there. Well, the Kurds have been fighting everybody in the neighborhood for thousands of years. They hate everybody. Everybody hates them. There's great speculation that if the Kurds declare independence from the former Iraq, that Turkey will invade Kurdistan. Well, that ought to be a Mr. Secretary, I ask you, what do you do then? You get on another airplane, right? You go out and see the Turks. Dear friends, please uninvade. There is no national consciousness there. So this the insurgents play on. They foster it. They encourage it. So things don't look too great. If you're trying to examine and see if this might work, and that's kind of what the terrorists are working with. Americans are going to quit. They have no knowledge of how it's going to work here. We can count on the Shias not liking these guys and the Kurds not liking those guys. And then there's another little bit that comes in here. It's called Iran and Syria. Safe havens, sources of money. Two desperate, desperate advantages to the insurgents. Just like there was once a place called Pakistan when you had the Soviets in Afghanistan. Home free across the border. Now, we won't even discuss questions about are there nuclear, I haven't foggiest idea. Did some of the stuff down in Iraq move up to Syria? I don't know. But it's really neat to have those two safe havens, particularly Iran, which gets up every morning and calls the Americans the great Satans again. You see, you guys are really lucky, you Americans. Every revolutionary government in the world needs, must have a villain, an enemy. We were at even before the Shah in Iran tumbled, and we have, you've done more to hold Iran together than you can imagine because you're the villain. You gotta have a villain. Does anybody get up in the morning and get mad at the Canadians? It's always the gringos, right? It's always the Yanks. And again, why? I don't know, but you know, there are lots of reasons, I guess. But there is a villain there that Iran has really been working on for many years, and then you go to Palestine and you look at villain. Now, I am persuaded of something. I'm not being glib. I think we could solve the Palestinian problem by giving American passports to every living Palestinian in the Middle East and have them all come here. Problem's gone. Nobody there. They'll be here. Stanford sweatshirts. Your police department will be full of them. I mean, I'm not even, I think they will. They would. Okay. It's easy if you're an insurgent looking at Iran. I want to tell you one more little secret thing about running an insurgency. You don't need very many people. Steve Call asked me once, how many Mujahideen, freedom fighters in Afghanistan did you arm? I said, well, 500,000. How's that for a number? And he said, because Steve's a very smart guy, he said, well, how many were actually fighting? And I said, Steve, I'll be polite. I extracted from my right ear each morning a number. How many are fighting? And my number was usually something like 20,000. Because you see, if you had 500,000 Mujahideen, meaning guys who had guns, half of them on the way in, half are on the way back, half of them are meeting their wives again for long, protracted periods, half are doing this, half, and maybe 20,000 are out there in harm's way. I would be surprised if Iraq today is being bedeviled by more than roughly 20,000. I've seen those figures come out of some pretty good analysis and made public. DOD doesn't want to say. And depending on which guy in DOD is speaking, you know, you get a lot of funny answers. I have to skip along. I am very uncomfortable about our war in Iraq. And I'm going to tell you why I am. Because I believe that the administration and the Pentagon have, in the past 2 years, done once the Iraqi army was destroyed, which we did very well, which our armed forces should be congratulated for and have been, which is their job. After that, it's all turned to muck because I think we've done a very, very bad job in both the Pentagon and elsewhere in planning and being ready for this war. And I see these maneuvers and these same concepts going well into the future, and I do not like that because if that happens, our cost will be higher and we probably will lose. Now, let me tell you, those of us, all of us, I'm sure, watched Baghdad fall and watched the looting begin. The minute I'd seen looting going on for one day, unstopped by American troops, I knew we'd made no plans, not a bit of planning. When American troops landed in Germany, we'd spent 2.5 years in this country figuring out what we were going to do with Germany when we defeated, including Henry Kissinger. No planning at all, not a clue. Oh, they're looting, what'll we do? You know, you're going to some captain running a Marine deal. What are you going to do, Captain? Well, I don't know what the hell to do. They're not told, stop the looting. Now, that has rolled on and on and on. That has absolutely got to be stopped. Remember, terrorism works. Not a nice concept. Terrorism works. Israel was created largely by terrorists. fighting the British, and then the Arabs. The Palestinian cause was advanced and become where we want a Palestine as a country due to terrorism. Terrorism works. It's cheap. It's easy. The bigger your opponent, the harder it is for him. Now, every day, again, in the Afghan situation, I'd get up and I'd say, okay, the Politburo in Moscow has said there will be 120,000 Soviet troops in Afghanistan. They held to that number. The Pentagon has said they first said 120 to 30,000. They've just managed to squeak it up to 150. That's not enough troops. And I would say every morning, don't double that number. Don't even think about it, Russians. Because if you do, it makes my job harder. And that's precisely what's happened in Iraq. If we do not, this is an intelligence assessment, at least double our force structure to about 300,000 men or more, we can't do it. And since nobody else is going to help us, we've got to do that. Now, the military is already saying, we've all read the articles, there aren't enough regular Army, National Guard, and Army Reserve to do that. Well, better figure out the political will. They certainly are. The Army today is well in excess of 400,000 people. The Marines have 189,000 people. Now, granted, many are tied up in mess kit repair battalions. Sorry, gang, this is called a rifle. It costs a lot of money to send them. It will infuriate Congress to send them. It will infuriate maybe the American people to send them. If it does, then it should stop, shouldn't it? Money. I think it's scandalous. When this war started almost a couple of years ago, the president announced he had $60 billion. That number is now tripled, almost. You cannot find an honest number in Washington. I know I've been trying for the last 4 or 5 days. I have spies all over the place. Any good number. Mexican bookkeeping is all over the place. It looks like about $150 billion has been committed, and the president's just asked for 80 more. And at the same time, we're cutting back Medicaid, Medicare, education. Will somebody please get the game on the table honestly? My theory is, if this government wants to take us to war, and I agree with it, and to stay in a war, and I agree with that, put it on the table. Let's say it's going to cost us over the next 5 years $500 billion. How do we live with that, with deficits like we've got? I don't know. I'm not an economist. I'm just a dumb spy, but I'm telling you, we ought to know, and sneaking up on it is not the way. I grew up, and many of us did in this room, in the Vietnam days. Sneak, 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 sneak. But it doesn't gonna do. Okay, so I'm gonna go very quickly to my formula for how we get better, 2 minutes. Double the size of the Army. Be honest with the American people, who are big grown-up people, about the costs and the casualties. Except the fact we're going to get no friends. I mean, that election rhetoric about we're going to go and join with our European friends. Look, it. France could no more launch 30,000 people to Iraq and sustain them for a year than fly to the moon. Militarily, they're incompetent, incapable, couldn't do it. That's a fact. Nor could the Germans. So that takes us down to Mauritius. Well, that 4 guys will go. It's us, like it or not. You tell the Americans the truth, tell them it's the long haul. Now, one of the worst things going around Washington this week is set a date for an exit strategy. We'll be gone by November the 12th this year, who knows. Dumbest thing in the world. You cannot possibly do that. All you're doing is saying to your enemy is, hang in there, gang, until that date. Or hang in there, gang, until that event. Now, the administration, one of the great faults of the military planners in the Pentagon, and I frankly think we have a failed Secretary of Defense. He should have been fired. The whole goddamn general staff should have been fired. Where did these guys? They're all fighting World War III, and they did it in 3 weeks. They just destroyed Saddam Hussein. It was a walkover. God bless them. Okay, next. Turn the page. Oh, shit. Mark Halperin said a very interesting thing not long ago in the journal. Mark said, God help the Army who's fighting for an idea, not a position. And he's right. take Okinawa, take Normandy, save democracy. Oh, hey, gang, not our job. Of course it's their job now. You've got to beef up the troops. We've got to be honest with the American people. We have to beef up the Iraqi military. The Defense Department has claimed that almost 200,000 Army and National Guard and police Iraqis have been trained. My friends tell me that if the number is 20,000, we're lucky. Now, an increase, an emphasis on doing that has happened. In the end, the only way we're going to get out of Iraq is if there are enough Iraqi Army, police, and National Guardsmen to defend whatever government they've got. That's the only way. And we have to train those people and then amalgamate them with us, and we fight side by side till they get confident, and, well, you know, you move that way. It's not being done. They've just discovered it at the Pentagon about 2 months ago and sent some new general out, poor man, with the orders, train the Iraqis. Right. Got to do it. We can do this. It is right to do it. Oh, and I forgot one thing. I believe the most important single thing we do to not only win the war in Iraq, but to save our position in the Middle East, to guarantee the possibility of the spread of freedom, which is a hell of an order in that part of the world, is to settle the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And I think now is the time. It is the time. We have Attila the Hun running Israel, a man the Arabs regard as the worst conceivable person to deal with, and his track record vis-a-vis the Arabs could support that assertion. We're finished with the former head of the Palestinian Authority, a new guy in Palestine. It is time that the United States, again, I say to you, O Americans, kick ass and take names. You've got to make it work now or it won't. Spend money on them, blackmail them, threaten them, ostracize them, do whatever has to be done to accomplish what must be done, a peace between Israelis and Palestinians. Do it. If it costs you $10 million in bribes or $1 billion in bribes this year to that country or the Palestinians, do it. It's a lot cheaper than killing people and being killed in Iraq. Do it. And one whole huge part of that animosity problem goes away. And we have proven we can do it. I'm going to shut up, so it's question time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What in the world is getting ready to happen in Iran?
I'm going back with the 82nd Airborne. No, I have no clue. I don't know. Let me tell you what I believe and I hear from pals who are trying very hard not to tell me anything secret, which is correct. But, you know, the Iranians, the IAEA, UN agency, says they've been working on fissile material, meaning stuff that goes bang, for some years. They've certainly gotten probably everything they need from the Pakistanis. This wonderful theater about Abdul, the Pakistani father of the nuclear bomb, you know, packing his bags with stuff and hop on a plane and go off and sell some, you know, want to buy some nuclear weapons. Here, got some nuclear. Bullshit. That's how they funded their nuclear weapons program, right, in Pakistan. But we got to trade with the devil, right? Right. I believe Iran is working on it. There's an interesting thing. The Europeans have been saying to us for a long time now, don't threaten war, you crude Americans, you who resort to the frontier violence of your background. I've been told that. I wish I could tell you the story I told back. Anyway, we, EU, will deal with these people. The Germans, the French, and the British will deal with the Iranians and get them to give up and abandon their program. Now, the only reason that the approach by the EU is even halfway possible is because the alternative in the Iranian eyes is the Americans will come and dump on them. We're back to America again. Okay? The only thing that makes it even halfway attractive to the Iranians to do something with the EU is because the Americans just might get out of hand. Isn't that interesting? And it should be to the advantage of the European community that we keep doing that. I mean, surely in their darkest nights, you know, they think, oh, good, maybe the Americans will scare the hell out of them, so they'll agree. The Iranians will build nuclear weapons. They will. I don't care what. And they will one day surface just like others have surfaced and say, we got the bombs. I do not believe for one minute we can do anything about it. Unless you do what they did to Libya, which was utterly ostracize it. That worked. It's our one victory in some time.
Who has a question?
I'm honored, sir. Or do you want to throw some at me?
Most of us have been fed pablum for a long time, and it's sure nice to get some beef to chew on.
Good.
The question is, where's the money? And I'm talking about the oil money from Iraq that was supposed to pay for the war and change the world.
Very fair question. We've had a lot of success in restoring Iraqi oil production, but of course it's attacked every day by the insurgents. There is a fair amount of money in there. I don't think any of it will ever come to defray our expenses. It can't. The expenses in Iraq itself are so great. Building. The kind of building that will give new governments an opportunity to survive will eat that all up. And I don't know where it stands right now, but you constantly read about the attacks on the pipelines, the refineries, which were in terrible shape anyway. It's worth noting, and I'm sure many of you saw this, the day of the election, there were 262 insurgent attacks in Iraq, the day of the election. Oil pipelines are a piece of cake, but it's why I say we must have more troops. And I don't care if they come from the 87th Mesquite Repair Battalion, watch the damn pipeline. And we also have to get a whole lot more aggressive. You do search and kill, hunt and destroy missions. Otherwise, you're just killed on their terms every time you drive by, which is not a good way to die.
Larry Brown. I know back in World War II, I wasn't there, but you stayed and fought until the war was over. In the 50s, I remember a 15-month tour in Vietnam, my first tour, 13 months, and it was down to 12, and now they're working on 6- and 8-month rotations. My question is, what impact do you think it would have on getting things solved there if we were to stay, keep our military there, until it was over?
As I said, I think there's no option but to keep our military there until we feel like it's safe. And of course, any government that gets established is going to ask us to leave immediately. You know, this is going to get more complicated. It doesn't matter if we have 500,000 men like we probably should. As soon as they're a government that's quasi-stable, maybe as soon as early next year, remember they build the Constitution, they have a referendum, then they have an election to create a government. If that government doesn't say sometime middle of next year, Americans go home, I'd be very surprised. And suppose they do we stay anyway? I mean, that's just a whole theological problem we haven't gotten to yet. Length of tours. The guy who runs the Army Guard the other day, you saw in the newspaper, says it's broken. The Army National Guard's gone. I mean, we can't do this anymore. There has to be a commitment. Stay, you know, maybe do a year, come home 18 months, but you're going right back out again. We have to hang in. That's the only way we can do it. Have a draft? No way. Pay soldiers $100,000 apiece to swell the size of the army? Forget it. It's going to mean much greater individual sacrifice on the part of our military units, reserve, active, or guard. And some of them are going to bitch like hell. Didn't sign up for this. And it isn't World War II. So I don't quite know the answer to that, but we got to count on being Americans. I don't know how to do it, but it's got to be done, or we quit. Tomorrow, preferably, so we don't add to that 1,449 people. Do it right.
Bill Stevenson.
Please wait for the mic.
You haven't said much about Afghanistan, which seems to be regressing to warlords and poppies. Do you have any comments on that?
Right. Poppies. Once when I was chief of station in Islamabad, a very senior government, not executive branch, from the Congress came out and really took me to task. All this opium is is drifting. Oh, he liked it. He was on it. Hi, Charlie. I'm fine. Thank you. He's reformed. Wrote me a letter the other day and said, I'm reformed. And I always liked you, Howard. Yeah, right. This senator upbraided me. Actually, it was Pat Moynihan. God bless him. And so when Senator Daniel Patrick upbraids you, you know you've been upbraided, but it's okay. I said, look, Senator, I can move 100 tons of ordnance, things that go bang and kill people, across into Afghanistan, and an entire Soviet Air Force and 110,000 people cannot stop me. A couple of tons of heroin every night is nothing. So it's really unstoppable. What we need to do, I believe, I think we made a tremendous start in Afghanistan, and the glory of Afghanistan, it may, of course, all fail. The nice thing about Afghanistan is, one, we have some NATO involvement, which I think must be stepped up considerably, and money from the EU. And I give Afghans, frankly, more credit. They're a tough bunch of people. And they will, with some luck and a lot of help, make it. So we got to just stay there and stay there and stay there and help them out, instead of, as we did at the end of the Soviet-Afghan War, walk away for 10 years, and what did we get? Taliban and Osama, baby.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm assuming that you do not feel that the American people will pull a Vietnam response to what is happening. Am I correct?
Very good question. I do not feel the American people will pull a Vietnam and want out if our government will be honest with us. If the president, instead of going around saying we're for liberty and justice and democracy, okay, great. Para two should be, that means the following. We have to do and make the following sacrifices. We have to pay for a war. Is there a war tax, a 5% surcharge on income? I don't know, but it has to be paid for. We can't go around pretending this is a short term, we're going to be out any day now. I get the feeling when I watch administration spokesmen. I mean, if you listen to Rumsfeld, we've already won everything. There's just a few things going on out there that are sort of, we'll fix those next week. What the hell? Be honest with the American people, and if we are prepared to spend of our blood and treasure to do which I think is a right thing, then let's do it on the up and up and know what we're doing. That's all I'm saying. And maybe the Americans would pull out. But if they do, you know, it's their blood and their treasure, isn't it? All I say is let's be straight and articulate the views. I think the administration is right in what it wants to do, but I think it's doing it very badly. And I think America will stand up. We have so far. President Bush regards the election as a referendum on the war. Okay. Now let us earn, you know, let you earn our confidence in you. That's all I'm saying. And fire the Secretary of Defense. That is a personal opinion.
Because of the other event that we have coming into the room, I'm going to ask everyone to stay in their seat to let Mr. Hart and Secretary Eagleburger and their families exit the room. Mr. Hart is going in for major lower back surgery next Friday. I know that all of us will be thinking of him and wishing him well, and looking forward to, as Dr. Turner suggested, your next visit to the Miller Center.
Thank you. God bless you all.